Nate Burleson, and welcome to CBS Mornings on the Go. Ahead on this Wednesday, June 24th, exclusive new reporting on the deadliest attack on American troops in the war with Iran. We talk with the wife of a wounded soldier who says the Army misled her about her husband's injuries. Plus, AI is having a big impact on the medical world. We will talk with a leading cardiologist who developed an AI tool that can detect hidden heart disease. We will also ask about another tool to help detect breast cancer. And do you want your kids to have the same type of summer experience you had? A parenting expert will tell us about a growing trend. It's called giving your kids a 90s summer. And yes, it involves outdoor playtime and less, much less, screen time. All of that and more ahead. We're going to begin, though, with the dangerous weather. More dangerous weather. Hail the size of grapefruit slammed the Texas Panhandle, and you can see it shattered the windshield of these storm chasers. I don't know why you're chasing the storm. It's another conversation for another time. Meantime, in Utah, wildfires continue to grow. At least two fires have burned more than 30,000 acres each. CBS News meteorologist Rob Marciano is tracking all of this. Rob, good morning.
Hey, what's happening? Yeah, it's a weird wiring to be chasing storms. I get it. I do understand it. And it's an adrenaline rush. But with that big hail, it's not fun at all. We'll talk about the fires in a second. We've got this cluster that's heading down toward I-35 between Wichita and Oklahoma City. Not severe at this time, but yesterday's have produced a lot of flooding. So we've got flood watches up from Tulsa to Oklahoma City to Shreveport. I-20 down here between Shreveport and Monroe. We've got a pretty good cluster of storms this morning that's creating potentially some flooding conditions. All right, here are the storms that will fire later this afternoon. I-25 corridor, including Denver to the east up towards Cheyenne. Could see a tornado, but really it's going to be big hail, big wind, and maybe some flooding. And then that same corridor tomorrow looks to be multiple rounds of seeing thunderstorms that can do the same sort of thing. Now to the fires we go. Two big fires burning, both over about 30,000 acres. Very little containment with these. We do lift the humidity levels just a little bit. We're going to get more of a subtropical flow out of this, maybe sparking a thunderstorm. But odds of getting that rain over those fires are low. Typically, thunderstorms just create more fires and wind. So the heat's obviously not helping either. We've got heat warnings and advisories from Phoenix all the way down towards Las Vegas. Temperatures up and over 110 degrees. But we do expect some cooling over the next six to 10 days. But we'll be sweating here in the eastern two-thirds. Matt, over to you.
All right. Well, we welcome that cooling, Rob. Thank you very much. It was a big win for progressive left in Tuesday's New York primaries. All three congressional candidates who were endorsed by New York City Mayor Zohra Mamdani won. For what this means for the national political scene, we're joined by Ed O'Keefe. Ed, good morning. OK, so Mamdani is emerging, obviously, as a kingmaker, at least here in New York so far, with remarkable influence on voters. So what do you think this Democratic Socialist sweep tells us about Democratic Party future in general? And what does it tell us about voters right now?
Well, two things. First of all, it tells us that New York City Mayor Zohra Mamdani still has an incredible sway over New York City voters and New York City congressional districts. But he has not endorsed outside the city. And a bunch of blue Democratic districts, in essence, just became blue, or more like midnight blue instead of maybe the blue I'm wearing right now. So, you know, they reflect, however, something that the Democratic Party is going to have a big conversation about in the coming years, especially as they get ready to nominate someone for president. And that is, what exactly did Israel do in the wake of the October 7th attacks? Was it genocide or was it something else? Because for a growing number of far left Democratic voters, it is genocide. And unless the candidate is saying that, it is a disqualifying characteristic for that candidate. But that won't be a factor in every race across the country. And Democrats certainly aren't nominating socialists everywhere else. Just 40 minutes north of where you guys are sitting, for example, they nominated a woman named Kate Conley, an Army combat veteran, to take on Republican Mike Lawler in one of the most competitive House districts across the country. The issue for her will be Republicans are going to run ads saying, does she associate herself with the socialists in New York City, or does she represent you? And it'll be up to voters to determine whether they think the Democrat in their district is more in line with those in New York City or elsewhere. And what this says more broadly, guys, among Democrats and Republicans, is voters want change. They are sick of the status quo. Two House incumbents were defeated last night in these primaries. They were supported by House Democratic leadership. We've seen other incumbents in both parties lose primaries this year, and will continue to do so. And it's why you've seen Democrats across the country have these races with less conventional contenders, because they are in fact intrigued and looking for someone who doesn't necessarily reflect the politics of right now, but a different kind of politics they want to see in the future.
Yeah, Ed, you sort of led me to my next question. What, if anything, do these results mean in New York outside of New York? And you said, listen, it's sending the message voters want change. Do you think this translates outside of New York?
not necessarily the socialism part of it, because you're not going to see a socialist candidate running per se in congressional races in Virginia or Texas or Arizona with any success. But the idea that Washington needs to be shooken up, that the U.S. relationship with Israel needs to be rethought, those kinds of themes will definitely play in all of these races. And what you're going to see almost immediately, probably by lunchtime today, is Republicans start running ads featuring these winners in New York City and trying to associate Democratic candidates across the country with them. That's not unlike what Democrats did when the Tea Party was getting popular back in 2010 and tried to take out moderate Republicans with those conservatives. What goes around comes around, and both parties are going through change.
All right, Ed, thank you.
It's time to take a look at stories that caught our eye. The lovely Kelly O'Grady is here doing the honors. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Gail. Yes, I am. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're going to begin with news that YouTube has settled a lawsuit with a Florida teen who said the site damaged his mental health. Now, that's according to a report from Reuters. The 16-year-old said he became addicted to the platform, leading to sleep loss, anxiety, and even depression. Now, terms of the settlement are confidential. The lawsuit also named Snapchat, Instagram, and TikTok as defendants. The case against those platforms is set to go to trial still next month. Now to stunning video of a 13-year-old tumbling down a 50-foot drop on a ride at Disneyland. You have to take a look at this. So this happened over the weekend on the water ride, Tiana's Bayou Adventure. You might have known it previously as Splash Mountain. The video was obtained by TMZ. Disneyland officials say the child had exited the ride vehicle right before the end of the attraction. A park staff member immediately stopped the ride. The child was taken to a hospital for evaluation and later released. The ride is now back in operation. I know, crazy video.
Bouncing, ricocheting down. Mm.
Not the Bayou Adventure that he was looking for.
No.
All right, finally, a dog rescue with a twist. I want you to come with me on this journey, all right, folks? Firefighters in Florida sprung into action after receiving a call that a dog had fallen into a lake. And you can see it there trapped under a dock as one of the firefighters pulls it to safety. Here's the twist, though. Turns out, not a dog. It's a coyote. So fire department officials say the coyote pup is headed to a wildlife rehab center where it'll be treated before it can be released back into the wild. Pretty cute, but man, coyotes are scary when they grow up.
I might have said it's been nice knowing you. I'm scared of them. I'm scared of them. I've seen them attack little children and little dogs.
Oh. It definitely happens in LA where I live. Coyotes are constantly eating dogs, but
exactly
people's pets. I was hoping that you would end that by saying that one of the firefighters adopted the coyote and hand-raised the pup coyote.
That's a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Kelly, you look good. I like the glasses.
Thank you.
I like the glasses. Thank you very much. Now, an update on a CBS News investigation on the Iran war. For nearly 4 months, we've been looking into allegations that the Pentagon failed to make plans to protect American soldiers at a command post in Kuwait. Six were killed and more than 20 injured in March. It was the deadliest attack of the war on the U.S. forces. So we're now getting a clearer picture of what some of the wounded soldiers say were gaps in their care. Jonah Kaplan joins us now with the story. Jonah, good morning. You've been doing some great reporting on this. Good to see you.
Gail, good to be with you. Those six fallen heroes and those 20 or so wounded, they're all from the Iowa-based 103rd Sustainment Command. And among the survivors was Chief Warrant Officer Rodney Bierman. His wife is speaking out for the first time now, telling us she thinks the Pentagon misled her about the true nature of her husband's injuries.
57-year-old Chief Warrant Officer Rodney Bierman has deployed overseas 5 times. His wife, Amy, told us she understands what to expect.
I knew that if anything ever happened, I would receive either an official phone call or an official visit.
That call came on March 2nd, 1 day after an Iranian drone struck this tactical command post in Kuwait.
They told me that my husband's injuries were classified as not seriously injured. He was treated and released back to duty.
Not seriously injured. Those are 3 great words for you.
That was the hope that I was hanging on to.
But Rodney was among the more than 20 wounded in the attack that killed 6 U.S. soldiers.
He took a lot of shrapnel from his head down to his legs.
Military medical records reviewed by CBS News show Bierman also suffered a concussion, hearing and vision loss, and blast lung, a condition caused by shrapnel damaging his lung tissue.
Some of those injuries he's going to have for the rest of his life.
The Biermans are among several survivors and their families who told CBS News they weren't being treated by the military as combat casualties, hindering their access to care. It's a claim the Army strongly denies.
Your wife was also told that you had a minor injury?
Yeah. Your husband was injured. He has a minor jaw injury. He's going to be returned to duty.
Sergeant First Class Corey Hicks was ripped apart by shrapnel from the blast and underwent multiple emergency surgeries at a Kuwaiti hospital. He's now in rehab at Walter Reed Medical Center in Maryland.
4 months in, I still haven't even seen neurology for my brain. So I've been raising flags with doctors and asking, hey, I still have headaches.
Concerns over gaps in care are the latest in a string of failures uncovered by our CBS News investigation. Soldiers say the Army disregarded warnings about thin defenses and ignored requests for medical supplies. Now they question the claim that the injured are back on post.
90% of those with injuries in this conflict have returned to duty.
Do you think the Army, the Pentagon, have tried to downplay this incident?
Absolutely, I think they have.
An Army spokesperson told CBS News, the care and well-being of our soldiers is of the highest priority, and any assertion that the Army seeks to downplay a soldier's injuries is simply not true. Last month, Amy Bierman reached out to her senator, who passed along her questions to the Army. In a response, a top general defended the not seriously injured determination.
Do you accept that assessment?
No. That assessment is unacceptable.
The Army tells us that designation, not seriously injured, isn't what it may sound like. By the Army's definition, a soldier who is seriously injured is someone who is at risk of dying in the next 72 hours. As for Chief Bierman, he applied for a spot and got into a rehab unit at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His wife Amy tells us, Matt, there is no timetable for when he can be home.
I think clearly, Jonah, there's some quibbles about the definition of seriously versus lightly injured. But what we can tell from your reporting is that these people will be carrying these wounds for the rest of their lives. And it raises the question of how many other soldiers are there like Bierman?
Well, and there's a disconnect, right? And when you are relying on that official information, every word counts. And when you hear those words, not seriously injured, Amy told us she then spread that news happily with everyone. And then when she heard from her husband, it just changed everything.
Psychological effects as well. Jonah, thank you so much for your reporting over multiple months on this story. It was another towering performance for an all-time great at the Men's World Cup. 41-year-old superstar Cristiano Ronaldo scored twice for Portugal, nearly scored a third time. He scored a goal in the last six World Cups. The final round of the group stage begins today. Cristian Benavides is in South Florida, where Brazil is set to play Scotland.
Off goes Cancelo, delivering the cross!
Portugal's legendary Iron Man, Cristiano Ronaldo, quieted the critics Tuesday, scoring his first two goals of the tournament.
It's Cristiano Ronaldo for Portugal! It's 3-0!
He's now scored in a record six World Cups, dating back to 2006. And here in Miami, a party atmosphere has taken hold with Scotland in town.
Little Havana has become Little Scotland.
Just such a wonderful crowd, such beautiful people, all having a good time.
The Tartan Army, clad in kilts and blasting bagpipes, made the 1,200-mile journey from Boston to South Florida and haven't missed a beat.
Boston was absolutely fabulous, and we thought that Miami couldn't live up to it, but it's just as good.
They have overtaken baseball games, paddle boats near downtown Fort Lauderdale, and bars on South Beach.
Come on, Scotland!
Today, their team will face off against Brazil, one of the powerhouses in global soccer, vying for its record sixth World Cup trophy. But the Scots aren't short on confidence.
What do you think the score is going to be?
1-0 Scotland.
3-0 Scotland.
No problem.
What do you think is going to happen during the game?
Probably about 3-4-0 Scotland. John McGinn for the first, and then Scott McTominay for the second.
Brazil are the best team in the world. And we think we're the best team in the world.
In the past,
The bagpipes are still playing here this morning. Now, it's been 28 years since Scotland has made it to the World Cup. And if they make it to the knockout rounds, it will be the first time ever that they do that. And they will do that if they beat Brazil today. And after the knockout rounds, as they say, no Scotland, no party. Nate, guys?
Yeah, they're ready to party.
Thank you.
They're ready to party. Yeah. I like
the
it.
Kilts. Yeah. I can't imagine wearing a thick woolen kilt in Miami in the summer.
You know, it's one
that
thing,
is dedication, people.
No doubt. And it's one thing to have people come here and enjoy the sport, but I truly am admiring the way that people have kind of lost themselves in everything totally. U.S.
Yeah, they've really embraced it.
The food, the culture, the bars.
Ranch dressing.
They found that they love us back.
Yeah, yes. No doubt Great. About it. Good stuff. Coming up, we look at how AI is helping doctors find conditions like heart disease. Plus, the new craze that parenting is focused on, and that is your kids having a 90s summer. Stick around. We'll tell you more about it.
In this morning's Health Watch, two big developments in the use of AI in medicine. A new study from the journal Radiology found that AI can spot patterns in mammograms that may help identify women at higher risk of developing breast cancer. We like the sound of that. The FDA also cleared the first AI tool that can detect certain forms of heart disease from a routine ECG. I was thinking, not EKG, ECG. That technology was developed by Dr. Pierre Elias. He's a cardiologist and medical director of AI at New York Presbyterian in Columbia. We're happy to say he's here in the studio with us because some of the breakthroughs, some of the things you're working on are so exciting to me. It was interesting to hear that you started your career as a software engineer and then you switched to cardiology. I think that combination is very interesting. Mm-hmm. You did that why? Because you saw that you could really make a difference based on that background compared to being a cardiologist.
Yeah, I think pretty early on I realized my North Star was we deserve better technology in healthcare, yeah. both as patients and as providers. And the question became, how are you going to build it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the amazing things about medicine is we have incredible technologies, but we also have some really cruddy technologies.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about doing something great for patients, you really want to say, how do we take the best of what's out there and bring it to clinical medicine?
And what have you discovered when it comes to heart disease and technology? Because there are so many tests for so many different kinds of things, but not in the heart field.
Yeah, around 7 years ago, I sat down with this fundamental problem, which is we don't have a screening test for the most common cause of death in the world, cardiovascular disease. Mm. We have mammograms, we have colonoscopies, we have pap smears, we have no equivalent for most forms of cardiac disease. And the reason for that's relatively straightforward. The way that we diagnose most forms of cardiac disease is either too invasive or too expensive to do at a population level. So we wait until patients develop symptoms,
yeah.
and then they're in a later stage of their disease. And what we know is when we diagnose people at later stage of the disease, they're more likely to have bad outcomes.
And so what you have found is that the AI is better at detecting potential heart disease than real doctors by a not insignificant factor. I think it was like by 74% for AI and like 68% for human doctors.
That's right. So what we saw was, you know, from medical school onwards, I've been taught that, you know, this cheap test, the electrocardiogram, which we do hundreds of millions of times per year, we can't use that to detect things like heart failure or valve disease or pulmonary hypertension. You know, I've read 10,000 EKGs as a cardiologist and I still can't do it. But it turns out AI can do exactly that. And one of the things that we actually tested is we had 13 cardiologists around the country read 3,000 electrocardiograms. And we said, how well does AI do and how well does a cardiologist do? Cardiologist got 64%, AI got 78%. And this is a yes, no question. So random chance is 50%.
Mm.
So I'm as far away from random chance as I am from the AI model.
Mm.
Now, the thing we realized, though, is this AI model is not meant to replace a clinician. What we've seen time and time again is we come up with new technologies that can do something that a doctor can't, right? When we came up with CT scans, it was better than the physical exam for looking inside of the body for certain things. So this is really, if you take away the word AI, just the next generation of innovation that creates a useful technology that helps us separate signal from noise and figure out who are the patients who are sick that we need to take care of.
So not leaving it up to AI to fly the plane. And you even said that you should use it as a co-pilot.
Yeah.
But how do we lean on AI without there being these false alarms or even creating confusion? And even some healthcare workers saying, I might even lose my skills when it comes to leaning on AI too much.
That's a great question. You know, so if I break that into two parts. So one, we have to study new technologies the same way we've been doing for the last 100 years. For any new therapy, any new diagnostic, you have to do the clinical trials. You have to understand how to effectively use the technology and what are the outcomes associated with it. If you don't do that, or you see any fly-by-night operations that aren't doing that, then you should really have a question, right? Because at the end of the day, we know how to study technologies and we know how to create new great technologies in medicine. We've done it for the last 100 years. And so we got to do the same thing with AI that we were doing beforehand. With the de-skilling, the question really becomes, if we get less skillful at a certain thing, does it create increased capacity to get better at something else? And if we get better at something else, are we having a net positive effect on
medicine? There you go.
And that's the real question we should be asking ourselves. Should we reimagine the work of what it means to be a doctor, a nurse, a physician assistant?
I like the way you think, Dr. Paralyze. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Now.
Do you remember riding your bike until the streets lights came on? Many millennial parents are feeling nostalgic for the summers that they grew up with. Now they are trying to recreate those experiences with their kids. The trend is called giving your kids a 90s summer. It's a push to swap screens for activities. So I recently sat down with parenting expert Emily Oster. She's founder and CEO of Parent Data. We talked about why parents are jumping on this new trend. So let's talk about this. What is 90s summer?
So I think when parents are thinking about this, they're really thinking about two things. One is less screens. And the other is less parent scaffolding. So I think the parent, we're seeing the summer that our kids have where they're scrolling on YouTube while we drive them to 45 different enrichment camps.
Yeah.
And we're thinking, like, what about the summer where I wandered around the woods and learned about the natural consequence of sticking a stick in a hole?
Yes.
It's bees. And so I think that's the kind of nostalgia there.
You know, I fall guilty of that because I hover and I want to overprotect my kids. Yep. But at the same time, I will criticize them and say, go outside. Go on an adventure. Come back bruised up, scraped up. I don't want to see you until it's nighttime. So how do we recreate that? How do we give that to them while still living in our same existence as 2020-something parents?
Yeah, so I think that's what's very hard, is you can't recreate the 1990s, as sad as it is. And so I think it's what parents need to think about is, what are the small pieces I want?
Gotcha.
I think for a lot of parents, it's about, how do I let my kids be out in the physical world a little bit more? How do I send them to the store, to the library, out to play without being so afraid? Because we are a little afraid.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, how do we find other parents to do this with?
Yes.
If your kid's the only kid alone in the woods, that's just weird. And so you got to, like, find out where can we push it with the other parents to say, hey, let's try to do this collectively so our kids can be together.
Yeah, because you need a little group to go on a true adventure. You know, as a parent, I struggle with screen time. So how do we deal with that?
So I think screen time is all about saying, when is screen time happening and when is it not happening, and figuring out to draw the boundary. So it should be totally fine as a parent to say, hey, when we're on the airplane, you watch TV as much as you want. But when we're at home and it's time to sit with your family at dinner, or it's time to go outside, you can take the screens. And that's not hypocritical. That's just rules.
Yeah. Compared to 90s parents, are parents these days a little bit more involved, more present?
So the data says yes. So the average amount of time moms spent with their kids in the 1990s is about 10.5 hours a week. That was up from about 7.5 hours a week in the mid-80s.
Okay.
It's now like 15.8 hours.
It feels so different.
People are spending so much more time with their kids, even though they are more likely to be working. So we're spending more time with our kids, which is great. But I think we can also recognize that, like, part of their development is learning to be on their own.
How do we deal with boredom for kids? Because you say sometimes boredom is good.
Sometimes boredom is good. I think if kids say, I'm bored, you say, that's great. You know, I think part of it is controlling ourselves. And when our kid says, are bored, we're trying to fill in. Oh, did you try this? You try this? What about this?
True.
What about this? Just to be like, yeah, all right, well, go do something.
And what are some of the go-to activities this summer that can be like a Kickstarter to a 90s summer?
I think an easy Kickstarter activity is go out and run an errand for me. Is actually to do something that you give them some guidance. Like, you're bored. That's great. We need cereal. Here's some money. Go outside and do that. And this is good because it gives them something to do. It gives you the ability to see they can go out and do something and come back. And that's confidence building for parents who want to give their kids more independence.
A little responsibility.
A little responsibility.
Put them on a little side quest action.
Side quest. Side quest. Before the adventure, there's a side quest.
I like. See, I'm reading 90s energy all over you. Emily Oster, thank you so much.
Great to see you.
Good to see you.
I like this way of thinking, Nate.
Yeah.
Because we used to all ride our bikes or stay until the streetlights come on.
Of course.
Kids today don't even know what a streetlight is.
Yeah, and we like to say it was a different time then, but was it, though? We should let our kids go on some adventures.
Keywords, boredom and responsibility. Okay, up ahead, the successful company Kidz Bop is celebrating 25 years of hit music for kids.
We welcome you back to CBS Morning. It's time to bring you some of the stories that we call Talk of the Table. Why? Because it's a table, Matt. We be talking. Nate, you're in pole position.
You know what? I was talking to somebody, and that's what my Talk of the Table is about. My conversation with UFC champion Conor McGregor, the notorious one.
Yeah.
The polarizing Irish fighter says he will return to the octagon 5 years after retiring. After a career filled with both success and scandal, I had to find out why. You've had some brilliant highs, celebrated by many, past some very public lows, headlines that might even make you cringe a little bit, and even your fans. What have you learned through the lows of, about yourself?
You know, fame has its pitfalls. You better move carefully in this world, for sure, probably even more so now. I've taken a lot of lessons in my life, and, you know, it's just about self-discovery, studying yourself, learning yourself, learning triggers. You know, I find myself even now still in a fight with an old version of me or old ways that don't serve me and, you know, new ways and a new version of me, the new me. So I still find myself in this balance. Right now.
That's both as a fighter and a man.
As a fighter and more a man,
more as a human.
Mm.
And make sure you keep a lookout for our full conversation releasing this afternoon on CBS Sports and Paramount Plus. And you can watch the Conor McGregor fight against Max Holloway on July 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern on Paramount Plus.
Love that he was still holding the cigar.
I like that, too.
Yeah.
Is he as tough as he seems? Every time I see him, he seems super tough.
He has a different energy about him. But what we were able to do was dig a little bit below the surface.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of UFC.
Yeah.
And I know him as a fighter. But I didn't want to go there and just pat him on the back for an hour.
Okay.
You know, we wanted to kind of extract some of the stuff that hit the headlines over the last handful of years. And he was open and honest, so I think people are really going to dig this interview.
Okay, pop quiz. Neat car or messy car? I know you're neat.
I got a neat car.
Gail?
Me too. what he said.
My Talk of the Table might have you heading out to the car wash this morning.
Yes.
Definitely me. A new survey shows that the condition of your car could put the brakes on your love life. So 2,000 dating Americans were polled, and 73% said they believe the way a person takes care of their car shows how well they take care of themselves. Right there, you see it. A majority said a messy car means a messy personal life. And on the flip side, a clean car shows that someone has their life together. Among the biggest red flags are trash on the floor, bad odors, and leftover food or drinks.
Oh, what about
you? My car's not that messy.
You didn't answer the question.
Yeah.
So I'm a working journalist.
It's a messy car.
No. There's an explanation, people. I am a working journalist, and I travel and, you know, in the car sometimes. We cover fires. And there may be some things.
Some stuff.
I'm with you, Matt.
I also, I allow Mother Nature to clean the car on the outside. Often because I feel like, I don't want to.
You don't take it to the wash?
No, so my kids are on me about this. My daughter's car is meticulous,
that's
spotless.
Good. That's good.
Mine is not, and I just realized it might say something.
I know. I could work on this myself. Yeah. Plane travel, as we know, can be very dicey, especially during the summer. We are all going to have a time this summer when someone is having a nightmare trip. So it's great when the crew helps you get through. So my Talk of the Table is the amazing crew on Delta flight number 997. 997,
okay.
Talking
right.
to you guys who worked through an almost 8-hour delay on a recent flight. We were in Atlanta a couple days ago for an interview. So we're supposed to fly back from Atlanta to LaGuardia on Monday. 8 hours later, we landed.
And we could have chosen not to take the plane, but we wanted to get you guys home. And so we want to say thank you to Craig, who is sitting in the middle, and Wendy, and Bradley sitting in the back. We appreciate you guys, and thank you so much.
We do appreciate you guys. The crew took such great care of us. The other passengers included pets and babies. Mm. They could not have been better behaved. So I, when it was over, I said, can I take a picture? That's Captain Todd Bell. He said, sure. And he invited me to sit down. That's Captain First Officer Hampton McDonnell, who was also helping people with their pets. Our fearless flight attendants, Craig and Raquel, Wendy and Bradley. I didn't get to see them, otherwise they'd be in the thing. And the screen on Delta, keep climbing. The reason why I'm highlighting this is because so many times we're on bad flights. But the crew, Captain Todd Bell, kept coming out and updating us on what happened. We leave from Atlanta. We're supposed to land at LaGuardia. Bad weather's moving in. They divert the plane to JFK. Okay, no problem. Going in for a landing at JFK, they said, he came on and said, you're not going to believe this. We now have to go to Syracuse.
Oh, my goodness.
Syracuse, New York. So we were literally on that plane. We had to land because we were getting low on fuel. We didn't have enough fuel to circle.
Yeah.
Always good when you figure out something when you're running low on fuel.
Yeah.
We sat on the ground. We didn't get home until 2 a.m. in the morning.
And you were here at 6 o'clock at the desk.
But it speaks to the crew of Delta that the guy, Todd Bell, kept us informed that when people were getting off, they were thanking the crew for being so kind.
That's what they train for.
Yes, but not
everybody
does that.
And they go above and beyond.
And they went above and beyond Delta.
That's awesome.
That is a young Zendaya singing Hot and Cold in a music video for Kidz Bop. She got her start by performing with the company famous for kid-friendly renditions of popular songs that are sung by kids. The 25 years since it began, Kidz Bop has racked up 45 number ones on the Billboard Kid Albums chart. It has 24 top 10 debuts on the Billboard 200 chart. That is only surpassed by The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, and Barbra Streisand. We learn how Kidz Bop adapts lyrics from your favorite artists, and I got the chance to meet a performer who went from Kidz Bop to Broadway. Matt Martinez is stepping into the dancing shoes of his childhood hero, starring as Michael Jackson in MJ the Musical on Broadway.
I remember having birthday parties as a kid that if you weren't dressed as Michael Jackson, you couldn't get in.
So you have a bunch of kids running around in red leather jackets
red leather jackets, the smooth criminal outfit.
Right, right.
Getting to play him now and like actually wear an actual like Billie Jean replica glove is a dream.
His journey to music began even before discovering the King of Pop.
What was it like for you the first time you performed for an audience and they applauded?
I must have been 5 or 6 or something like that. And I go on stage and immediately run off before the music starts. And then I kind of ran right back on and I did it and I got the bug.
At 10 years old, everything changed when he got a call back for Kidz Bop. He spent the next 3 years recording music videos and performing in concerts.
It was crazy. I was living a rock star life. You see streaming fans in the audiences like dying to meet you.
How much would you credit your time at Kidz Bop to the successes that you've had?
I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for that, truly. Kidz Bop got me out of my show.
None of that would have happened without Michael Anderson.
This is a relic. This is our very first Kidz Bop album, original CD.
Who came up with Kidz Bop while working at a record company.
The two owners of the company had school-age kids, and they were realizing there was really nothing in between Barney and Britney Spears. So we took current pop songs, re-recorded them with kids singing them, and if there are any questionable lyrics, we could steer them in a different direction. Too hot, hot, yeah. My very favorite lyric change is in Bruno Mars, That's What I Like.
That's what I like.
The original lyric is strawberry champagne on ice that I changed to strawberry milkshakes so nice.
Strawberry milkshakes so nice. Gasoline and groceries.
Shaboozy's team reached out to us. A bar song, Tipsy, is one of the biggest songs in history.
Yes.
Obviously, we can't touch a song called a bar song.
Yes, where everybody getting tipsy.
So I rewrote it as a bop song, in parentheses, a Shaboozy cover.
Someone turn it up and dance along with KB. They know we and Shaboozy got a history.
Kids Bop will tour the country this summer to celebrate 25 years. But for the kids involved, having fun and making friends might be the best part. And getting to meet their heroes, too.
Oh, what's up, you guys? Hi, how you doing? I'm Matt.
Hi, I'm Sophie. How are
you? Hi, I'm Matt. Nice to meet you. What's up, man? Oh, my goodness.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. I used to watch you on the Uptown Funk music video.
No way. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's so wild.
What's it like to meet kids who are now in Kids Bop, who probably see you as a mentor and as an inspiration?
Now being able to see how young I was, truly, through them, is wild. It's just really, really full circle, and I'm just really excited for them.
Yeah, it was really interesting for me to learn about Kids Bop because, you know, I listened to The Real Thing, and so we talked a lot about that, but there is something that is incredibly important for young children to be able to access music that may not be meant for them in a fun and kid-friendly way.
But they did it in such a great way, changing the lyrics.
Yeah.
It's always great when kids can sing along to songs that you like and it's appropriate for them.
Yep.
Genius. This seems very genius.
It is very genius.
It is a genius.
And the fact that Zendaya and people like Matt Martinez go on to have these incredible careers is proof in the pudding.
I like Kids Bop, man. I really do. You know, every once in a while, it'll catch you off guard, though. You'd be walking past the TV. I'm like, ooh, that's my jam. And they'd be like, I like big trucks, and I can't. I'm like, I thought that was something else. I like it, though.
Well, you like big trucks, too.
I do like big trucks.
The bigger, the better.
That's what I say. That'll do it for us.
Okay.
We'll see you tomorrow on CBS Mornings before we take a turn. Take it easy. We'll see you tomorrow.
Big trucks.
Everything has to come to an end.
Now streaming only on Paramount Plus. The acclaimed series, The Chi, reaches its final chapter.
We from Chicago.
It's my home.
From Emmy Award winner Lena Waithe.
There are two types of people in this world. Those that reach for more and those that just enjoy what they got.
This The Chi. Anything's possible.
Singing this song to you.
The Chi, the final season now streaming only on Paramount Plus.